Welcome to the spiritual teaching. Oh, actually, it's the guiding light, but I'm using the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi as the book that I'm working with. And we're in the section called The Guru and His Grace. And I'm going to start at the top of page 68 today. But before I do that, I'm going to play a song. And it's Christmas time. See my sweater? And so we're going to listen to Christmas music for just a few weeks. I'll be playing Christmas music. I'll be playing Christmas music from the Awakening Together Christmas list. We actually have an Awakening Together Christmas list. If you want to listen to it, I have a couple hundred songs on it. You can, just go to YouTube, go to the Awakening Together channel, go to the playlists, and then you'll find our Christmas list. And I like to just let it play, while I'm in the kitchen doing things. So be aware that we do have a Christmas list that you can play. And I'm going to play a song from that Christmas list. This song is called The Gift.
A poor orphan girl named Maria was walking the market one day. She stopped for to rest by the roadside, where a bird with a broken wing lay. A few moments passed till she saw it, for its feathers were covered with sand. And soon cleaned and wrapped it was traveling in the warmth of Maria's small hand. She happily gave her last peso on a cage made of rushes and twine. She fed it loose corn from the market, watched it grow stronger with time. Now the gift-giving service was coming, and the church shone with tinsel and light. And all of the temple brought presents to lay by the manger that night. There were diamonds, incense, and perfumes, and packages fit for a king. But for one ragged bird in a small cage, Maria had nothing to bring. She waited till just before midnight, so no one would see her go in. And crying, she knelt by the manger, for her gift was unworthy of him. Then a voice spoke to her through the darkness, Maria, what brings you to me? If the bird in the cage is your offering, see. So she trembled, she did as he asked her, and out of the cage the bird flew, soaring up into the rafters on a wing that it feel good as new. Just then the midnight bells rang out, and the little bird started to sing a song that no words could recapture, for its beauty was fit for a king. Now Maria felt blessed just to listen to the cascaded notes sweet and long, as her offering was lifted to heaven by the very first nightingale's song.
All right. So, as I mentioned, we are here for the guiding light, the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And I'm beginning on page 68. And here is the question. What is the significance of prostration to the guru or God? And of course, I don't know if you all know, but in India, that's a, you know, that's something people do when they walk in and they see the guru, they prostrate down, you know, onto the ground, which actually I enjoy doing very much when I'm in India. You know, it has a real devotional feel to it, but it's not something that we typically do here in the U.S. So what is the significance of prostration to the guru or God? And Ramana Maharshi answers. Prostration signifies the subsidence of the ego, and it means merging into the source. God or guru cannot be deceived by outward genuflections, bowing, and prostrations. He sees whether the ego is there or not. So that's kind of an interesting thing. You know, obviously, Ramana Maharshi is saying that, you know, when you bow all the way down, like you do in India, bow all the way down to the ground in front of a guru or God, which there is often like a, you know, a statue, that represents the subsidence of the ego. Subsidence, of course, meaning it has gone away, right? The subsidence of the ego, which is probably why I like doing it. I said it has a very devotional feel to it, right? I really love it. And in fact, sometimes when I'm at Ramana Ashram and I'm sitting in contemplation or meditation, sometimes while I'm there, I'll feel overwhelmed with devotion and I will move to the front. And I will prostrate in front of the, they have a picture of Ramana on the sofa that he used to sit on. And I will bow down before that, you know, on the ground, before that picture, and sometimes stay there for quite some time. And usually at that point, the mind is just completely silent. You know, it has just completely fallen away. And I love that so very, very much. I have been known to do it right here in my house when I'm alone. Sometimes when I'm in meditation or contemplation, again, I'll just feel overcome by devotion, and I'll get down on the floor and I'll you know, bow down and prostrate. You know, prostrate, I guess, is what they call it. Just bow down completely on the floor, you know, I'm not doing it to a particular god or guru. I'm doing it because I think because the ego has stepped aside so deeply, and I just want to dive into that silence, you know. And so I'll prostrate on the floor right there in my office or wherever I happen to be meditating and contemplating. So it's something that I enjoy very much. But it's interesting because he says, God or guru cannot be deceived by outward genuflections, bowing, and prostrations. He sees whether the ego is there or not. So what I get out of this is that when we are moved in the way that I just described, you know, sometimes when I'm home completely alone, nobody sees me, right? It's just me and me. And my heart is so overcome with devotion that I get down on the floor and I prostrate. Like this, you know, that's very sincere. There's no one to see it. It has to be sincere. But certainly there are people who in India, you know, who walk into a temple or a meditation hall and they do this thing, you know, at a show, right? You know, it kind of reminds me in the Bible when Jesus talked about that, he called it the hypocrites, who pray in public, right? So that everybody sees them. And he says, they have received their reward right there. Everybody saw them and thought they were holy. That's as much as they're going to get out of it. And I really think Ramana Maharshi is sharing the same message here, that you shouldn't really come in. And of course, he's speaking to someone who was raised that when you come into a certain place, you're going to prostrate in front of the guru or the statue that represents God. He says you shouldn't really come in and just do that, you know, because that's what you were taught to do. This needs to be something that really comes from the heart. This is when you're overcome with devotion. This is when the ego has subsided and you are called into this devotional position. So I think that's really all there is to say about that. So I'll move on to the next question. Will not Bhagavan give me some prasad from his leaf, his grace? For those of you who have not been to India, prasad, it's like a bit of food, or it could be a bit of milk that comes from the guru, which you take. And it's very similar to those of you who are raised Catholic. It's very similar to communion, right? In communion, you take the little wafer that when you put into your mouth, it becomes supposedly the body of Christ, and you drink the wine, which supposedly becomes the blood of Christ within you. It's a very similar idea. It's a blessing. It's a blessing that you take from the guru, and you take it in like that. In fact, one of the things that I really enjoyed, although you know I'm not Catholic or Hindu or anything else, but one of the things that I really enjoyed when I was at the Ramana Ashram is that when they would have the prasad ceremony, they let everyone who was there come and take of it. And that's what I liked, was the fact that they let everyone who was there come and take of it. Because of course, if you've been to a Catholic church before, you know, really only Catholics are supposed to come and take of the communion. And to be honest, it's usually like that in a Hindu environment too. Only the Hindus are supposed to come and take of prasad. And so one thing that I really enjoyed about Ramana Ashram is everyone is invited to come and take of the prasad. So I think I just like the openness of it. But those types of ceremonies are not overly important to me. But, you know, again, to a person who is raised Catholic or to a person who is raised Hindu, these types of ceremonies can be very important. So here we have someone who apparently sees this as very important and says, will not Bhagavan give me some prasad from his leaf as the mark of his grace? Oh, and by the way, for those of you who don't know, in India, you know, in many places, and certainly at Ramana Ashram, they actually eat on these very, very large banana leaves. They don't eat on plates. All the food is served on this very large banana leaf. And so that's why the questioner is saying, will not Bhagavan give me some prasad from his leaf as a mark of his grace? And here's what Ramana Maharshi said: eat without thinking of the ego. Then what you eat becomes Bhagavan's prasad. You see that? Eat without thinking of the ego. Then what you eat becomes Bhagavan's prasad. Okay, one moment. I want to grab a book here because that reminds me of something in the teachings of Inner Ramana, which of course you all will get to very soon, because I know many of you are reading this book right now as a part of gentle healing. And actually you've seen this before, because although this is in Inner Ramana, it was also a thought of awakening. So this will sound very familiar. It landed in both places. But again, let's look at Ramana Maharshi's answer, and then we'll look at this from Inner Ramana. Ramana Maharshi said, eat without thinking of the ego. Then what you eat becomes Bhagavan's prasad. All right, here's what it says in the teachings of Inner Ramana. Seek self, and of course this means true self. Seek self before you go to sleep at night. Let the search for self be the first thought when you awaken. Inquire for the self as you eat your meals. Be aware of the heart as your hands are working. As you recline, contemplate the self. As you walk, carry your heart with you. Never let your attention stray from your love of self or your inquiry of it. Let this be your one purpose and live life fully. Ask only for self, and awareness of self shall be given. So Ramana Maharshi's answer reminds me of that very much. Instead of, you know, taking a little rice and milk or something, a little porridge or something from my leaf and putting it in your mouth and thinking, you know, you've done something. now you will receive grace, right? Instead, practice letting go of the ego while you eat. Practice focusing on the true self while you eat. And that's really my prasad. That's where your grace comes from. So again, will not Bhagavan give some prasad from his leaf as a mark of his grace? Eat without thinking of the ego. Then what you eat becomes Bhagavan's prasad. And I want to speak a little bit about this, not that you all don't know this, because I think that you very much do. But I just feel that I shouldn't whiz by this without speaking about it. He says, eat without thinking of the ego. That really means eat without thinking about me, right? Eat without thinking about my life. Eat without thinking about my opinions. Eat without thinking about my problems. Eat without thinking about my day. Eat without thinking about what I'm going to do tomorrow. Eat without thinking about what so-and-so thinks of me, right? Right? That's what this means. Eat without thinking of the ego. So, you know, one practice when we eat then, if we really want this prasad, one practice when we eat would be to really just pay attention to the experience of eating. You know, notice what the food tastes like, what the food feels like, even, you know, what it sounds like. Because, you know, if you really are quiet, you can hear yourself chewing, what it sounds like to chew, you know, what it feels like when you swallow, what the food looks like on the plate, what the fork or chopsticks or whatever feel like in your hand. And really just be present rather than thinking. One thing that I've noticed about mind wandering is that when I am focused on a task, like if I'm creating web pages for the Awakening Together Retreat House, there isn't a lot of mind chatter going on. There's focus and concentration and ideas coming. And I actually feel very inspired and very much like I'm just following what's coming. But when I'm doing the more mundane things of life, like taking a shower, brushing my teeth, eating, especially eating alone, you know, washing dishes, doing laundry, this is when the mind wandering really comes in, right? And so sometimes it's during these more mundane tasks, these things that our body and brain know how to do without our attention. Because it's so well wired into the mind. Anything that our body and our brain knows how to do without attention, that's when we're really available to give a lot of attention to mental chatter, mind wandering. And so that's a good time to, you know, if you're reading the teachings of Inner Ramana, to practice the mantra, or a really good time to just give attention to the moment. Give attention to the experience of eating, the experience of doing dishes, the experience of brushing teeth, being in the shower, etc. But again, this is what he's saying is his prasad, that we really accept the grace. In this case, he's talking about eating, but I'm going to say when we are able to do these mundane things without being lost in mental chatter, without thinking about me and my life and my opinions and et cetera and et cetera and et cetera. You know, it's really surprising, shocking, how much time we spend thinking about me, isn't it? You know, the ego is vain and arrogant. There's just no doubt about that. So, the next question is not the literate man better qualified for enlightenment in the sense that he stands in no need of guru KRPA. I have no idea how to say that. I'm going to say Krupa, but I have no idea how to say KRPA. But I am going to look this up and find out what the heck this is. Oh, it's the guru's grace. I like that. That's easier to say grace than whatever KRPA is. So the question is not the literate man better qualified for enlightenment in the sense that he stands in no need of the guru's grace? You guys hear that question? Is not the literate man better qualified for enlightenment in the sense that he stands in no need of the guru's grace? I mean, this sounds to me like the question is saying, if you've really studied the scriptures and you really know the scriptures well, you can become enlightened without any help beyond your intellectual knowledge, which most certainly is the opposite of what we are seeing right now in the teachings of Inner Ramana. In the teachings of Inner Ramana, what we're seeing right now is that we are so incredibly addicted to the mind that it's impossible for us to set ourselves free. In fact, that's what we've seen Jesus say. That's what showed up last week in this teaching. That's what showed up in the Nisargadatta teaching, right? That for man, this is impossible. And so the fact that I have memorized A Course in Miracles or some other scripture, NTI or the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita or anything else, is not at all helpful. But apparently that's what this particular individual says. So we'll read the question again, and then we'll see what Ramana Maharshi has to say. Is not the literate man better qualified for enlightenment in the sense that he stands in no need of the guru's grace? And Ramana Maharshi says, even a learned man must bow before the illiterate sage. Illiteracy is ignorance, and education is learned ignorance. Both are ignorant of the true aim. The sage is ignorant in a different line. He is ignorant because there is no other for him. So that's a very interesting answer. Now, first of all, not all sages clearly are illiterate. Ramana Maharshi was an average student all the way up to high school when he awoke. Nisargadatta was illiterate. He worked in the fields as a young boy instead of going to school. Yet he was still a pretty smart guy because he was able to open a small chain of cigarette stands, right? And you don't get a small chain of cigarette stands, you know, if you're a fool. So he was a smart guy, even though he was not literate. But when Ramana Maharshi says, even a learned man must bow before the illiterate sage, in this case, illiterate doesn't necessarily mean that the sage is not educated. In fact, we know that because he refers to ignorance at the end. Let me go ahead and read the whole answer again. He says, even a learned man must bow before the illiterate sage. Illiteracy is ignorance. So he's calling the sage ignorant. So it's kind of a new approach. Usually we don't call sages ignorant. He says, illiteracy is ignorance. And education is learned ignorance. Both are ignorant of the true aim. So he's saying the sage is ignorant of the true aim. And so, you know, this should be bringing up some curiosity. What was it that I read recently? I remember, I think it was in the Tao Te Ching. I read the Tao Te Ching last Wednesday. and it talked about how the master attempts to confuse those who think they know. Do you remember that? It seems like Ramana Maharshi, this technique is coming through Ramana Maharshi right now, because this method that he's using to teach is one that makes you go, huh? You know, like, you know, huh? And if you're going to hear him, you're going to have to listen with a different ear than with that educated mind. Because if I have an educated mind, if I'm very educated in the Upanishads, for example, I know that we don't call a sage ignorant, right? Ignorance is everybody but the sage, right? So all of my learned knowledge from all of the scriptures, I know we don't call sages ignorant. So, and again, I know this because I'm really smart. I'm one of these people who's learned, and enlightenment should be easy for me. I shouldn't even need the sage's grace because I know so much, right? And one of the things I know is that we don't call sages ignorant. And yet here Ramana Maharshi is. So it sounds like that technique of confusing those who think they know, really in order for them to have to look again in a different way. It sounds like that technique is getting used here. So again, let's look at what Ramana Maharshi says. Even a learned man must bow before the illiterate sage. Illiteracy is ignorance, and education is learned ignorance. Both, all right, the sage and the educated man, both are ignorant of the true aim. Now, you know, again, this learned man has to be looking at Ramana Maharshi at this point going, huh? You know, like, what are you talking about? Which maybe is going to enable him to listen if he can't follow him. If Ramana isn't saying the things that he already knows, right? So both are ignorant of the true aim. The sage is ignorant on a different line. He is ignorant because there is no other for him. So what that says to me is the true aim is to merge with God. That's the true aim. And I'm not going to merge with God by getting really, really smart about the scriptures, right? I'm going to be the me, the I, that is really, really smart about the scriptures. But the sage he's calling also ignorant. And he says the reason the sage is ignorant is because he's ignorant of this true aim. Why? Because he's already merged with God, right? He's not aware of a goal to merge with God. So both the learned man who thinks he can do it by himself, he's ignorant of the goal to merge with God. And the sage is also ignorant of the goal to merge with God because it's already accomplished. And again, I think that the reason this answer is given in kind of a strange backwards kind of way is because it is that technique to confuse those who think they know. So that they have something they have to contemplate, something they don't easily understand. The next question, is it not to obtain the guru's grace that presents are offered to him? So the visitors offer presents to Bhagavan. And that's true. That's also a tradition in the Hindu culture that when you go to see a guru, you bring him things. You know, maybe you bring him fruit. Maybe you bring him flowers. Of course, financial donations. But you bring something when you go to see a guru. You don't show up empty-handed. So is it not to obtain the guru's grace that presents are offered to him? So the visitors offer presents to Bhagavan. Ramana Maharshi says, why do they bring presents? Do I want them? Even if I refuse, they thrust the presents on me. What for? Is it not like giving bait to catch the fish? Is the angler anxious to feed them? No. He is anxious to feed on the fish. So what Ramana Maharshi is saying is that when people bring him gifts, it's because they want to get something, right? When you put a worm on a hook, it's not because you care about the fish. and you want to feed the fish, it's because you want to catch the fish and eat the fish. So Ramana Maharshi is just really saying this whole tradition of bringing gifts to the guru is not pure. Now, I'm certain that there are people who brought the gifts out of complete purity. You know, it's just their culture to do so, and they brought them. But as a whole, Ramana Maharshi is saying that basically they're trying to buy the guru's grace. And this, of course, is not anything that he's in support of. So the devotee goes on, is the theosophical idea of giving successive initiations before attaining enlightenment true? Is the theosophical idea of giving successive initiations before attaining enlightenment true? Ramana Maharshi says, those who attain enlightenment in one life must have passed through all initiations in their former lives. So initiations, I mean, I know that's an English word, but I feel it probably has a very specific meaning in Hinduism that in order to fully understand the question, it wouldn't hurt if we could know what those meanings are. So I'm going to look up initiation in Hinduism. Okay, rituals associated with initiation in Hinduism. The most notable feature in Hindu religious ritual is the division between purity and pollution. Religious acts presuppose some degree of impurity or defilement for the practitioner, which must be overcome or neutralized before or during ritual procedures. So it's really initiation, then, in this case, would be purification. Right? That's really what this is referring to, becoming purified. So again, with that understanding, let's look at this again. Is this theosophical idea of giving successive initiations before obtaining moksha true? And Ramana Maharshi says, those who attain moksha or enlightenment in one life must have passed through all the initiations in their former lives. You know what I feel? I feel that's not so important. You know, one quote that Michael Langford quotes all the time is that sometimes the words that come out of the mouth of the guru are just a reflection of the foolish mind of the questioner, or the foolish question. And occasionally, when I read Ramana Maharshi, I feel this is true. I feel that he's just answering in a way that fits with their belief and understanding. And I don't want to say that he has any reason. I don't want to say, like, because he doesn't feel like it's worth it to go any deeper, because there may not even be such a thought in his mind. That would be an interpretation on my part. It's just what comes, you know, like, let's say a Christian came up to me, you know, somebody who's really a Christian, a Southern Baptist, and their whole belief system is Southern Baptist. And I understand the Southern Baptist belief system. And let's say they say something to me like, isn't it true that you have to be saved and baptized before you go to heaven? You know, I might say something like, well, in reality, saved and baptized are traditions that people believe you have to go through before you get to heaven. But actually, the purity of your purpose is much more important. You see how I still included the get to heaven, right? It's like kind of pointing in the right direction, but I didn't go into this, well, there's no such place as heaven, or so something like that is maybe happening here. And to be honest, I don't feel like really going much further into it, except to say that we all know that purification is necessary. And maybe this is really what Ramana Maharshi is pointing to. the purification is necessary. Obviously, the impure mind is not prepared for enlightenment. The impure mind would certainly shrink from the experience of the death of the ego. And so what we can do in this lifetime, even if enlightenment never comes to us, is that we can continually attempt to purify. And those of you who were here when I taught about, I'm going to call it the truth about reincarnation, you know that the individual soul, there is no individual soul that reincarnates. That's the story. That's the belief in a separate me. There is no separate me. Therefore, there can be no separate me that reincarnates. There is consciousness. We are all consciousness. We are all that same one. So right this second, that consciousness is living as Shauna, Regina, Connie, Joanne, Dawn, Jacqueline, Sharon, Barbara, Rayla, Ruby, Jay, Lynn, right, etc. Right this second, that consciousness is each and every one of us. And that consciousness is also whatever people appear to be in other lifetimes, right? So it's not that there's a reincarnation of an individual soul. It's that consciousness is having many, many different lifetimes of experiences. But hold on, I'm going to walk away from you for a moment, because now, before when I taught this, I said, I wish I could use a visual aid. Well, guess what? I can now. So hold on. And I'll try to describe this visual aid for those of you who are listening to an audio later. Hold on, I'm getting all caught up in my wires. Okay. Let's see. Oh, good. Here's a Sharpie. I have everything I need right here. Isn't that cool? All right. This is a wadded up tissue. But this wadded up tissue represents consciousness. And right now I'm pulling a little piece out of the wadded up tissue. That piece represents, we'll call that one human life. And let's say this human is someone who steals and rapes and lies and has a very deep I am bad thought. And what I'm doing is I'm saying all these things as I'm drawing on the tissue and I'm creating like these little black spots. Well, when this person dies after having that type of a lifetime, then when they die, that person is reabsorbed into consciousness. But when that person is reabsorbed into consciousness, and that person is gone, but are you able to see this? The black spot is still there on consciousness. So what happens then is another person is born, but it's not a reincarnation. It's just another extension of consciousness being born. But when that person is born out of consciousness through that area where those spots were, that poor person is born with that same, I'm going to call it darkness. So it's not that a person reincarnated. It's that an imprint resulted in another birth with some of the same tendencies. So what happens is when we are living a lifetime and we purify from whatever tendencies we were born with, and I can't erase this black. I wish I could, but we'll just pretend like I'm erasing it. You know, as I purify from these beliefs, even if I do not become enlightened, when I die, you know, I'm reabsorbed into consciousness. But then in that same spot where the next birth occurs, it's now more pure because I purified. And so this next birth of consciousness, not of Regina or anybody else, this next birth of consciousness has a much stronger opportunity to become enlightened because it was born without those imprints. So one thing that most of us forget, because again, we do believe in separation. We do believe I'm me, right? And I want to become enlightened for me, right? But it doesn't matter whether you believe that or not. That's not what's going on here. We are consciousness, and we're waking up for consciousness, which from our perspective is more of a we than a me, right? So even if you do not become enlightened in this lifetime, the real purpose is for consciousness as a whole to wake up to itself. So even if you do not become enlightened in this lifetime, any purification that you do prior to physical death is helpful to consciousness awakening. And I know that this is very unselfish and very difficult for the ego to get excited about. But it's the truth. And this again is why Jesus said things like, my life is a ransom for many, right? That was obviously misinterpreted, but he understood that whatever he did in his life to purify and awaken benefited all of consciousness. It wasn't about him, right? So when Ramana Maharshi says then that those who attain moksha in one life must have passed through all the initiations in their former lives. And again, we see that the word initiation in this case means purification, right? He's talking as if an individual soul reincarnates because that's what this person believes. But what he's really referring to is the process that I just explained to you. That, for lack of better words, that spot in consciousness was purified by whoever lived the previous lifetime. And so it was reabsorbed. But then when a new life came out of that spot, it was a more purified mind, and therefore it had a better chance at enlightenment. So there we go. And I love understanding, the truth about reincarnation. Again, the ego doesn't like it. The ego does not like to know that, I, Regina, am going to end, right? The ego wants to think that somehow this spiritual path is about making Regina live forever. But that's just not true. Regina is a temporary, what is born will die. Regina is a temporary manifestation, but the consciousness that perceives itself as Regina right now is not a temporary manifestation. And any work that Regina does is helpful to consciousness. And again, we're all that same consciousness right this moment, right? Right this very, very moment. So that's why one person's spiritual practice really benefits the whole, right? Because it is really just one. All right, so the next question. I hate big words because for those of you who don't know, I am an illiterate person. Theosophy says that Yananis, after death, have to choose 4 or 5 lines of work, not necessarily in this world. What is Bhagavan's opinion? So here, obviously, this person is talking about Hindu stuff that they've learned, which we don't know, nor do we really care about. And Ramana Maharshi just says, some may take up work, but not all. Next, the devotee says, are you conscious of a brotherhood or invisible? And then R-S-I-S, I'll say Reese's. Oh, that makes me hungry. Reese's, get it? Let's see what this word means. R-S-I-S. I love peanut butter and chocolate together. I think that's one of the best things anybody ever thought of, is to put peanut butter and chocolate together. A seer or a sage. So are you conscious of a brotherhood or invisible sages? Sages, right? Like, people talk about ascended masters. Are you conscious of a brotherhood of invisible sages? And Ramana Maharshi says, if invisible, how can you see them? The devotee says, in consciousness. Ramana Maharshi says, there is nothing external in consciousness. Now, again, it looks like we're having this conversation with this learned man, right, who knows so much. But I just want to say that, you know, a lot of people believe in things like ascended masters. I once did. You know, I believed I was listening to not really an ascended master, but a divine being when I was listening to the Holy Spirit and writing NTI. When I was listening to the inner voice and writing NTI Galatians, I believed I was listening to a being named Jesus. When I wrote down the teachings of Inner Ramana, I believed I was listening to a being named Ramana Maharshi. And many, many people have these beliefs. I have since come to see that those are the ideas of children. You know, when we're, and by children in this case, I mean somewhat spiritually immature. When we believe that we are, you know, me, Regina, and we believe that I am ignorant, and we believe that I am lacking, and we believe that I need to get enlightenment somehow from someone else, consciousness imitates. Those that we know of in one way or another as enlightened beings. And I got to tell you, even though I went through this phase of believing this myself, it's kind of funny. It shows how long it takes to really wake up to wisdom. Because one of the very, very first things that inner wisdom taught me was that there was no such thing as ascended masters. And it's funny how it taught it to me. It's a silly story. In a way, it's a little confusing. You know, if you're trying to bridge from believing in ascended masters to realizing there are none. But what happened for me, and this was when I still lived in Massachusetts. This was a very long time ago. I was sleeping. And I woke up, and I don't believe to this day I woke up in a dream. I just woke up, but I woke up into a light. Everything was light. And I knew the light to be Jesus. And the light communicated with me, but it didn't use any words, nor did I hear words. My mind didn't translate the communication into words. But I understood the communication purely. I understood everything that it was telling me. And I would ask it questions. I would speak to it. And when I spoke to it, I used words because that was the only way I knew how to communicate. But what it taught me was that when we awaken into the light, into enlightenment, all attachment to a personal identity dies. It's gone. It doesn't exist at all. However, the identity that was present when the awakening occurred can continue to be used by the light for the purpose of communication to those who believe in identities. The next morning, when I started reflecting back on this experience, I began to doubt it. I began to wonder, was it a real experience or maybe it was just a dream? And in fact, somewhere in my journal, I wrote a prayer saying if this really happened, can it happen again? And the next night, the exact same thing happened. I awoke into the light and there was this conversation where it was explained to me that the identities, and again, it seemed like I was having a conversation with Jesus, but that would have just been a used identity, right? And it was explained that if I was to awaken in this lifetime, that the Regina identity would be used even beyond my lifetime, but that I would have no association with that identity, right? It'd be like you know, it'd be like pretending to be an elf for Santa, right? Like if you work somewhere and you're pretending to be an elf and you're fulfilling that role completely while you're interacting with the kids, but you don't for a second believe that you're an elf, right? Well, consciousness speaks through the identity of Jesus and the identity of a Virgin Mary and the identity of a Ramana Maharshi and the identity of anything that people believe in. But there's only consciousness. There aren't all of these different identities. There's no such thing as ascended masters. And I don't mean this as an insult, because all I mean is that everyone is going to pass this point. Only the immature spiritual aspirant believes in ascended masters. And again, I don't mean that as an insult. I just mean that as you mature past a certain point, you no longer will. Just like only children believe in Santa Claus, right? It's not an insult to the children, but there's a certain level of maturity to cause them to believe in Santa Claus and to believe that reindeer fly and to believe that Santa can come down a chimney, right? And at some point, they pass that point of immaturity and the mature mind can no longer believe that stuff. It's the same thing with ascended masters. They don't actually exist in spite of the fact that you may have an experience with an ascended master. Right? And the reason you would have an experience with an ascended master is because it's consciousness acting as that ascended master in order to reach you. So this is really what Ramana Maharshi is pointing to here. Again, are you conscious of a brotherhood of invisible sages? Ramana Maharshi says, if invisible, how can you see them? The devotee says, in consciousness. Ramana Maharshi says, there is nothing external in consciousness. The devotee then says, can I realize them? Ramana Maharshi says, if you realize your own reality, then that of the invisible sages and ascended masters will become clear to you. There is only one master, and that is the self. There is only one master, and that is the self. So you can tell that Ramana Maharshi is attempting to very clearly tell this person, ascended masters are not real. They're not true. There is only consciousness. It could be consciousness acting as an ascended master, but there is only consciousness. The next question that he asks is reincarnation true? So you guys have just seen what I have to say about that with my little tissue demonstration. Let's see what Ramana Maharshi says about that. I mean, after all, just a moment ago, Ramana Maharshi talked about you know, how someone would have passed, if they were enlightened in this lifetime, they would have had successive initiations or purification in their previous lifetime. So maybe, you guys think, Ramana Maharshi believes in reincarnation? What do you think? Let's find out. So again, the question, is reincarnation true? Ramana Maharshi says, reincarnation exists only so long as there is ignorance. There is really no reincarnation at all, either now or before, nor will there be any hereafter. This is the truth, right? You know, it's just not true. You can only believe in reincarnation. Again, by reincarnation, we mean, you know, a soul, like in a previous lifetime, you know, I was the Apostle Peter. I was Lao Tzu. I was, you know, people love that kind of stuff, right? I was whoever. I was Regina. No, that's not true. It's not true. Now, consciousness was. So if we put I there, well, then I have been everyone and I am everyone who ever will be. Right? But that's not what people mean, is it? They mean this individual me, I was the Apostle Peter and you weren't. Right? Interesting. NTI says, you are Peter, but it's talking to every single person who reads the book. Right? So reincarnation exists only so long as there is ignorance. There is really no reincarnation at all, either now or before, nor will there be any hereafter. This is the truth. And it's funny because the next question is, can a yogi know his past lives? So hopefully this is a different person asking the question and not someone who just can't hear at all. But we will look at that question next week. So I am marking that. And I want to thank you all for coming and hanging out with me. I'll be hanging out with you for the rest of the evening. Have a good night. Bye.